Welcome. Welcome, friends, to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, where I am reading some listener mail this morning, and I like this one. Here's one from Scott. He says, I like ArtCast a heck of a lot. The sound quality is above par. I really like the acoustic guitar lick theme music, and you do an above-average job as host, not just another Joe with a mic, mixer, and network connection. Hey, well, thanks, Scott. I am glad that I'm above average, and that's what we try to do here at ArtCast. And today we hopefully have another above-average show with Udi Dahan, once again talking about service-oriented architecture. And on this episode, we're going to think about how we can bring together Windows Workflow Foundation with Windows Communication Foundation to make a solid foundation for our architecture. And now let's welcome to ArtCast, Udi Dahan. Hi, this is Ron Jacobs, and once again, I am back with Udi Dahan, the software simplest, and we are talking more about autonomous web services and how that relates to a new technology that's coming out now called Windows Workflow Foundation. But before we get too much into workflow, Udi, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about some of the other concepts of service orientation, like boundaries, and how does boundaries play into the need for workflow?
Okay, well, first of all, it's great to be back. And SOA, this idea of autonomous services, we've been having problems defining exactly what an SOA looks like. And one of the big ones is boundaries. I mean, you've got the tenant that talks about services have explicit boundaries. Well, how do you know that your boundaries are right? I mean, this has been plaguing us since the dawn of object orientation. You know, how do you know that the responsibilities between objects are right? The same thing with components. What goes in one component and what do you have to split up between a bunch of other components? So once we get to this idea of services, how do we know that our service boundaries are right? And possibly the biggest thing that points us in the right direction is transactions. After working on numerous systems, it's one of the topics that comes up pretty quickly. You know, how are we going to make sure that all our data is consistent? Well, getting back to that self-governing point of autonomy that we talked about before, it wouldn't be very wise for a service to allow somebody outside the service to lock resources inside it. At the most basic level, this means rows in its database. So if a service wants to be self-governing, it can't let anybody else lock anything within it. It has to do it itself as a result of some request. So once we start looking at the various WS specs that have been raining on our heads for the past year or so, we realize that WS, atomic transaction, is out. This idea of, you know, getting a request, opening up a distributed transaction, calling a web service, getting the results back, calling another web service, getting those results back, mushing them together, saving them in our database, and then firing off something to the mainframe, all of that within a single distributed transaction, well, that's just not going to work in the real world, where, like we said in our previous ArtCast, that mainframe may be responding slowly, and we don't know if the other web services are up. So if we can't do these distributed transactions between services, we can't let services lock each other's resources, and we put that together with the idea of asynchronous communication, our whole idea of business logic begins to become a little bit muddled, because we can't just call a web service, get the results back, synchronously pass those results on to somebody else, because their synchronous behavior no longer exists. We need something in the middle to manage all this stuff. Once we send a request out, we need something to know we're waiting for a response, that it'll take those results when they get back and start doing something else, which really means that the workflow that we're talking about in SOA is a kind of distributed workflow, but from the perspective of the service.
The magic of distributed transactions does something wonderful for you, which is it eliminates a lot of state management headaches. Because you just say, well, you know, I'm going to assume everything works. And if it doesn't work, it all goes away. But oftentimes, especially the more loosely coupled systems are, the less you can rely on that kind of model. Because many times, not only can you not use a distributed transaction for the reasons that you mentioned, like locking and maybe trust issues and so forth, but also between loosely coupled systems, sometimes the last thing you want to have happen is to just throw all the work away, like what happens when a distributed transaction rolls back. You might want to be tracking, hey, something went wrong on this transaction and we're going to try it again, or we need to know how many times things go wrong and what went wrong, or maybe the alternative is a human has to get involved and start calling people and sending emails and faxes and stuff to fix it. So these are all reasons why distributed transactions kind of break down. But now, because we've taken away this wonderful state management facility, we have a very complex state management problem that leads us to an interesting solution that you've been thinking about with workflow.
Well, that's right. I think you bring up a very good point about dealing with failures, that the systems that we're building are getting larger and larger, and we're talking about really huge systems that are being built today. And the whole idea of making these systems robust and making them work and keeping our data consistent all the time has become a serious task. And this idea of, well, you know, we'll just let the infrastructure handle that, it'll just automatically roll everything back and everything will be fine, might be fine within a single business or within a single product unit. But once we start building these systems that scale out larger and larger, that encompass more businesses, more product units, more IT infrastructure than before, we start to have to explicitly say, well, what happens if that doesn't work? The classic example of distributed transactions that is always given in the universities and in the presentations around the world is the travel thing. You know, you go to a website and you book an airline and you book a hotel and you book the car. That's not a distributed transaction, at least not behind the scenes. Even the banking stuff that people actually think are single atomic transactions don't actually work that way. There is something behind the scenes, code that developers have written, that handle all the special cases. What message to send to who, when, what to do when a response comes back. And all that state management, as I don't want to say as difficult as it is, because, I mean, it's code that we used to write long before we even had distributed transactions. It's sort of time travel once again. That this workflow that we have to write has to be managed. The state of the workflow has to be managed. And that's a difficult thing to get your head around, this idea of, I can't just do it. It's not just one single process, but it's a bunch of steps that I sort of have to tie together. And the difficulty is not so much in the tools that we have, but in our style of thinking about how systems work together.
You know, the travel example is an interesting one, because last spring I used the internal travel website that Microsoft uses to arrange corporate travel, and I was arranging a trip to London. And when I did, I booked a hotel and a flight, and everything appeared to be fine, between the time when I had located the hotel and the flight, something happened. You know, maybe the hotel filled up suddenly or whatever. But when I was completing the transaction, actually purchasing everything, something went wrong and the hotel wouldn't do the reservation. And so the website said, oh, you know, something went wrong, you have to pick another hotel. So I went, fine, okay. So I picked another hotel. And then I completed the reservation, and I'm thinking everything's fine until I get back. And a few weeks later, I'm looking at my credit card statement, and I noticed that I got charged twice for the airline ticket. And so I questioned the travel people who support Microsoft, and they said, oh, yes, I see what happened is that British Airways saw that you had the same exact reservation on this particular flight, so you would have had two tickets. So they automatically canceled one, Of course, when they automatically cancel one, they don't automatically refund the money. So they happily canceled the ticket but kept the money. And then it took me some 6 weeks later to finally get the money back out of them. But the interesting part about all of this is that it just made me realize that the developers of this travel service had not developed adequate compensating actions. So when I had went to complete this first purchase, they got the plane ticket, but when the hotel failed, they did not compensate the plane ticket, and the whole mess ensued.
Well, I guess you can't really blame them, because these systems are a lot harder to build than you think. I mean, when you just start into it, you say, well, call in, cancel it. Well, what if he didn't get the cancel message? How do you know that he got it or that he didn't get it? I mean, in a perfect world, you have distributed transaction, you've got reliable messaging, everything works all the time, and it takes absolutely zero time for everything to occur. But, you know, that's not the real world. So they send a message to the airline, and the airline does something, and maybe they get a confirmation back in email, and hopefully they have some agent sitting on their SMTP server to actually handle that. And it'll put things back into the database where a trigger will fire on the appropriate table, and that'll call some other web service. These are really difficult systems to build. The more interconnected they are, the more sub-states have to be handled. I mean, there aren't going to be exceptions that just bubble out of nowhere and tell you, hey, this went wrong, how do you want to handle that? You actually have to code something up that actually actively checks for things going wrong. And when that happens, somebody has to go to the business people and say, well, you know, what should we do when the hotel can't book it because it's full and it puts the person on standby? Should we continue as if nothing's wrong, or should we actually go to the airline and put them on standby too, or should we just stop the whole process, sort of freeze it, and come back to the user and ask them what they want to do? And for the most part, this is the first time business people are being asked questions like this. I mean, you're IT, you should be able to handle this. I mean, all these partial failure things, why do I have to think about it? You know, just book the transaction and that's it.
Well, you know, we could think about this in the same way that if a person were doing this, if I had been talking to an agent on the phone and they were doing these operations, the kinds of states of the transaction, that it as it progresses through different phases, and in fact, really, a state-driven workflow is an interesting way of thinking about managing the complexity of this, because then we could account for the transitions between the states, the events that happen that cause us to end up in these weird places, like this kind of unusual state where we got one part of it but not the other, which is, you know, in my experience of 6 years at Microsoft, that's the only time that's ever happened to me. Do you think that works?
Well, I think there's really no other way to handle it. I mean, once you sort of get out of this mode of, well, it'll just be okay and let's plod through it as much as we can, then you sort of come back and reanalyze the problem. You split it up into different steps. Say, okay, let's say that I receive a request to book an airline ticket on this day with this carrier and this hotel between these dates and those dates, and the rental car for this period of time. Well, each of those systems, I mean, whenever you go to a rental car agency, they make you fill out this form and put all this information in, and then there's this policy that you're agreeing to by signing there. Well, all of a sudden it becomes like these systems have to sign the contract between them and have to sort of pass that back on to you. So there's a whole other world of legalities that we're not even going to get into now, but one of these days it's going to come back and bite us you know where. And once we start looking at these things saying, well, if it is a state-driven workflow, what are my states? So I have my initial state where I receive the request and say, okay, what do I have to do? I have to pass along this request to the hotel and this request to the airline and this request to the car rental agency. And I have to save this intermediate state. And I have to tag it with an ID and I have to be able to correlate that with all the messages that I sent out. And then I'll happily go along my way doing other work until I receive another message. And when I see that message, I have to look at some place in the header and realize that this message belongs to a specific workflow. Go to my storage area, take out that workflow object state, and pass it the message. Then that workflow will have to understand what that message means, and it'll do some other state. For instance, the airline comes back and said, okay, we have reserved a ticket for you on these dates and these dates, and this is how much it's going to cost and everything. So it saves that in there. And once again, goes back to the storage until the car rental agency sends it a message. And once again, we look in the specific header, find the workflow state, rehydrate it, pass it the message. It does its own set of work, and it keeps on going along like that. But the simple cases are actually pretty simple because we don't have that many states to deal with. But for instance, if we don't get a message back until a specific point in time, we might want to do something about that. If this is an express order or this is a preferred customer, all of a sudden we see this simple little three-step workflow breaking up into a whole bunch of other little cases where we may need human intervention, where sending a message to human and getting a message back to them is workflow just like any other workflow. And doing this without tools is pretty horrific. I mean, you have to actively set up the data storage. How do you actually save the state of a workflow? What is the state of a workflow? And that's one of the things that I really liked about how Microsoft is bringing forward the Workflow Foundation, that they're making the developers actually think about what workflow is. You have certain actions, and these actions are strung together into, I don't know, I call them streams. And you can be along on one stream, and you can jump from that stream to another stream as a result of a specific event. And the state of the workflow is what point you're at in the workflow now. But not only that, what points were you in that workflow in the past? Sort of what steps did you take to get where you are today? So you've got the state of the workflow, and then obviously you have to connect the state of this workflow to the rest of your database, talking about your customer database and your order database and all your other information that the workflow is tied to. And that's one of the things that isn't specifically handled in the Workflow Foundation because it's not really its business. But as us, as developers that are developing systems with long-running workflows, we have to keep all this in mind and we have to synchronize all this kind of stuff because otherwise the systems just won't work.
You know, this is a different sort of a mindset, isn't it? Because I was thinking about how people who build websites like this think about, often they use the session object to store this sort of transient state of, you know, the hotel I selected and the flight I want and that kind of stuff. But many who have taken sort of the next step will store that transient state in their business database, you know. So like our website, for example, if I go on there and I start a trip, but I don't finish it and I just log off the browser, when I come back, it will say, hey, you have a trip in progress, you know. So they've obviously not just relied on the session state, but they pushed the state to somewhere more durable and more permanent. And it's interesting to think about the workflow as a container of this sort of transient state. I guess you could keep part of the state in the transient sort of workflow, wherever you keep the workflow data, and part of it in other places if you had to. But do you think that's a good idea to keep this sort of transient session state-like stuff in the workflow state?
Well, I think that they have to be tied together, but the next big part comes when the developers sort of ram up and get hit by reality is the classic web farm state where they say, well, you know, it might be nice and good on one server, but now we got to run this on a whole bunch of servers. And the server that may be holding the transient state may not be getting the next request. We may not want that to happen. And once you start talking about more robust systems, you say, well, this information about where I am in the workflow, what has happened so far, what has to what we want and expect to happen in the future. We need a way to have that data persist between restarts, because let's face it, servers crash and network equipment goes up in smoke. So in order to build our systems to be reliable, to be robust, and be able to handle the internet scale type of things, or even just systems that, you know, there is some specific data that 100% of the time can never, ever, ever get lost. Orders is a good example. Or if you're talking about safety critical systems, there's a whole bunch of other data that can't get lost. So I think this view of transient data that we sort of count on it being there and push along our workflow with that, that's a little bit naive in the real world. So I think the first step is actually to take that transient data and, yes, tie it with the workflow and look at exactly how BizTalk did it. Every single thing that goes on is persisted, because you can't count on getting the message before the next restart. So you always have to make sure that you have that data persisted somewhere. So once you, the second that you wake up and you get a message, you can keep on going. So there is the surrounding data of what is the hotel you ordered, what are the dates of your stay, and all that kind of stuff that has to go into the database. And then you have the actual state of the workflow, as in, well, the hotel has been reserved, the flight has put me on as tentative for the dates that I want, but I know that there's another airline that can give me the dates that I want, but they don't have the business class, and the user specifically asked for business class. So we can put them on hold for at least a week until we see how that first airline is doing. And the car rental agency, well, they're fine, but from our experience with them, they have a habit of canceling things at the last second. So we're going to have to know how to handle that when that happens. So all these intermediate states have to be explicitly coded as separate actions in the workflow.
So, okay, I'm trying to imagine now how I would build one of these. So if I would have on my server, I'd have a number of services that could receive messages that relate to the process of building up this trip, you know. So maybe a service that you kind of request availability and you're looking for hotels or flights or whatever, and you get back a message saying, here's what I have available. So now we've started a workflow that's entered a state where the customer is searching for the particular flight they want. And we may never hear from them again. They may say, forget that, we're not going to buy that trip, and in this end of story, right? But because we've issued them a quote, which could be legally binding in some cases, right? So we have to save the state of that quote. And when we do, then we're going to, you know, sort of dehydrate the workflow and say, okay, we're going to persist that workflow off in case they come back and say they want to buy it. Is that how I would do it?
Well, technically speaking, I think everything that you said was dead on, but the example you gave was a little bit off. The example that you started out with is user comes in, asks for a price quote, and we go to the service to ask it for information, and it'll send the information back and we'll present that to the user. If we have a service that has the information about availability, the kind of interaction that we'll want to set up in order for this information to be available to consumers is more a publish-subscribe type of thing. So there are a number of services like our web server that is serving up information to the public that would like to know about availability of certain flights and certain hotels. So it subscribes for that information to the service which has it. And that service, as availability is updated, publishes this new data to everybody that's listening. And our web server that receives that information, and here I'm talking about web server as the server that is serving information to the public, and not necessarily a single IIS box. So this web server has received information, possibly saves it to its own database, so that when customers come in and ask for availability requests, it doesn't actually have to go talk to the service, because it has locally cached the data about availability itself. But the rest of what you said about the kind of interaction that's going along between services and requests is exactly what would happen.
I don't know. I find it hard to imagine that travel services are caching availability of seats on flights. I mean, I would think that changes so dramatically that they wouldn't be able to do it. But nevertheless, I mean, even if you could do it, I guess it, to me, that's sort of a side issue. But the interesting thing is, rather than thinking about the in my head, rather than thinking about this process of several message exchanges which are going on for me to reserve a do a trip, right? I'm checking on flights. I say I want that one. I send my credit card information and purchase it and receive acknowledgments of all these. Rather than seeing those as sort of independent, discrete steps, I see them as part of a larger transaction which spans multiple message exchanges and time and binds them all together using a workflow to manage the state transitions. And that, to me, seems very, very exciting because, see, like last year, I spent all year going running around the world giving this talk called Patterns for SOA, where I advised people against building these kind of transactions just because of the difficulty of the state management. But this year, I think we can revisit that topic and say we have now a better solution.
Well, I think that on the solution side, you're definitely right. But I think also on the problem side, these are the problems that we have to deal with. I mean, when we receive a request to book a vacation by a client, we actually have to handle all these intermediate steps and intermediate failures that can occur. Otherwise, you know, the customers will just take their business elsewhere to services that can actually do things a little bit better and are more robust. It also sort of comes back and hits us on our end, like the example that you gave the last time, that just because one link in the chain isn't performing that well, does that mean that the whole chain has to become unusable? Well, I'd hope not, because otherwise the hardware guys are going to be making a killing this year, because there's really no other way we can handle this. So the problem sort of comes back from the hardware and infrastructure domain and comes back to pure software about forcing us to actively think of problems in this way, of long-running transactions, as you call them, which are logical transactions, and that we, as developers, have to actively manage the state of the transaction. And we have to know, or rather specifically ask the business people, what do you want done when this occurs? So once we have figured out the problems and what we need to do, then we can start to saying, okay, what are the messages that are going to go back and forth? How am I going to correlate these messages to each other? How am I going to synchronize what's going on between different services at the same time? Because eventually, we're going to have the same client calling up a travel agent and the travel agent doing the same work on our own system. So we're going to have two concurrent workflows running that have to deal with the same data. So eventually we're going to get to the point where we have these internal transactions that are locking, which are going to cause the minor failure states between workflows. And that's going to become a very, very interesting problem to deal with. And the tools that we're going to have with Workflow Foundation will enable us to sort of rise up to the next layer of abstraction and say, okay, now we can start dealing with more business cases, more specific failure cases that we'd like to, that we couldn't do it before.
You know, what's kind of interesting when I think about it, you know, when we talked last time about the autonomous services and the nature of duplex conversations, in a workflow, you can have an activity which is just like call a web service, right? And that's just going to be a synchronous call, you know, just wait for a response. But it might be, rather than having an activity there, you might want to actually transition to a state which is like, I'm in this state where I made a call to a web service and I'm going to stay in this state until the duplex other end of that, they send me back the kind of response that I need. Anyway, it just seems like a much more complicated thing that we could accomplish using a workflow than rather than just putting an activity there, say, call this web service.
It is quite a bit more complex because when you think about it, before you just, you know, call a web service, get the results back, take those results, pass it to another web service, get the results back. That very simple action of, you know, request response synchronously, to implement that asynchronously and knowing that you can possibly fall between the request and the response arriving, and that you're going to have to be able to correlate those things based on data that you saved the first time through, makes it that much more difficult to code even simple cases. And when you get into the whole issue of, well, let's make sure that we don't lose information, because once that first request comes in, I mean, let's take a switch from the travel domain to the order handling domain. If I receive a request, which is an order for $100 billion, and I start to process that, and in the middle my server crashes, when the server wakes up, what just happened to my order? I mean, I didn't finish processing it, so it isn't in the database, but the call was already made, so it's not in the HTTP queue. So, you know, what just happened to our $100 billion? That's something that developers are going to have to start looking at. So that gets into reliable messaging and how we deal with transactional work even within the steps. I mean, we would really like to have that order sitting in a queue waiting for us to take it out. And we explicitly go open a transaction, take it out of the queue, start writing it against the database, so that if anything fails in the middle, either it'll stay in the queue or it'll end up in the database. So we're going to have to sort of close the loop even on a single message. Then you sort of start thinking about, okay, if that's a single message, what am I going to have to do on entire message exchange patterns?
Well, I tell you what, Udi, we need to write this up into, like, I would love to build an application, maybe not a huge one, but a little sample application where we could maybe illustrate how some of these patterns work. Because I've been thinking, what would be, you know, a killer tech ed session that I could do this year? Because that's what I've got to do. I had a killer session last year. It did really, really well. And I have to come up with something that's just as equally valid. And so this would be awesome if we could do this. And I'm looking forward to doing many tech eds this year and showing up in various portions of the world. And maybe even coming there to Israel, which has always been a lifelong dream of mine to come visit Israel. So will you help me with that?
I'm there. Wherever you need to go, we'll pull it together. We'll create the killer tech ed app of the year.
All right. Okay, well, this has been great fun. Thanks a lot, Udi, for being with me here on ArcCast.
Thank you, Ron. I had a blast.
Udi Dahan, ladies and gentlemen. The software simplest. Talking web services, workflow, and how these things go together. You know, this conversation really opened my mind to a lot of new possibilities. A lot of stuff that we knew we ought to do but was really hard to get done now seems like it might be very possible using workflow. What do you think? You know, you got to give this a shot. Hey, and by the way, I did find out that I am going to be at Tech Ed Israel in May, so I look forward to meeting Udi and all of you guys down there in Israel. That's going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to see if we can pull together that sample, because that's what we do here on ArcCast.